The most important change of all, however, was that the ball itself became livelier. Though when exactly, why exactly, and by how much are questions that are surprisingly difficult to answer. The quest to produce a sturdier, more resilient baseball was a long-standing one. Ben Scheib, co-owner of the Philadelphia Athletics and a manufacturer of sporting goods, who had begun his colorful career in the leather goods industry and so knew his way around stitched products, for years devoted much of his spare time to trying to make better baseballs. In 1909, he invented the cork-centered ball. Cork centers were lighter than rubber centers, which meant that the balls required more twine, wound tighter, to obtain their regulation weight and circumference. Scheib's new ball, nearly everyone agreed, was notably livelier. Hits seemed sharper, particularly in the late innings of games when balls normally grew spongy. Then, sometime after the war, when precisely is another curiously vague matter, Scheib's company, A.J. Reach, began to import a superior grade of wool from Australia, which was even springier and could be wound tighter still around its feather-like cork. The result was what was commonly known as the rabbit ball, because of its liveliness. Interestingly, Reach strenuously denied that the new ball was livelier and produced results from the U.S. Bureau of Standards showing that the ball was neither more nor less bouncy than those that preceded it. Most players didn't agree, however. There was a great difference between the ball that was in use when I broke in and the rabbit ball that was handed us a few seasons ago, Walter Johnson told a reporter in the summer of 1927. This ball travels with much more speed than the old one when hit. Although home run numbers grew generally, no one came close to matching Ruth's totals. In 1920, when Ruth hit 54 homers, no other player hit even 20. In 1921, his 59 homers were 11 more than the next two best hitters combined. By July 1921, in only his second year as a full-time batter, Ruth had already hit 139 home runs, more than any person had hit in a career before. So compelling is his presence at the plate, so picturesque and showy and deliciously melodramatic his every move and appearance, that he is, from the point of the onlooker, a success even when he is a failure, wrote one observer. Even his pop-ups, that is, a ball hit in the air and caught for an out, were sensational and were often hoisted so high that he had comfortably rounded second base before the ball dropped into an infielder's glove. In Babe Ruth's first year in New York, the Yankees' attendance more than doubled to 1,289,000, even though they finished third. The Giants had never attracted a million fans in a year. The Yankees now never attracted fewer. John McGraw was so offended by Ruth's assault on the principles of scientific baseball and so envious of the Yankees' success that he ordered them to leave the Polo Grounds and find a new home. In 1922, Jacob Rupert began building Yankee Stadium, the greatest ballpark ever seen at that time. He placed it on a plot of land carefully chosen to be within sight of McGraw's Polo Grounds. When finished, the stadium cost $2.5 million and was 50% bigger than any previous ballpark. From the day of its opening, it was known as the House That Ruth Built. Babe Ruth became celebrated as no sports figure ever had before. Everything about him, said the writer Paul Gallico, seemed larger than life. His frame, his enormous head surmounted by blue-black curly hair, his great blob of a nose spattered generously over his face. He wasn't good-looking, but he was irresistibly charismatic. As his friend and teammate Waite Hoyt put it, he was one of a kind. If he'd never played ball, if you'd never heard of him and passed him on Broadway, you'd turn around and look. Ruth's rise to fame could not have been more impeccably timed. It coincided precisely with the birth of tabloid newspapers, newsreel films, fan magazines, and radio, all vital cogs in the new celebrity culture, and his arrival in New York brought him into the throbbing heart of the media world. Newspapers began running a daily column entitled What Babe Ruth Did Today. When Babe Ruth had a bunion trimmed, it received national coverage. Interest in him went way beyond the sports pages, however. He featured on the covers of dozens of magazines that had nothing to do with baseball, from Hardware Age to Popular Science. The Literary Digest ran an admiring profile, as did the New Yorker soon after it began publication. No ball player had ever attracted this kind of attention in the wider world before. He came to be regarded as a kind of god. In 1921, a team of professors at Columbia University hooked him up to wires and something called a hip chronoscope, subjected him to a battery of physical and mental tests, and pronounced him one man in a million for his reflexes, eyesight, hearing, and nervous stability. He even scored 10% above normal for intelligence, a fact that he boasted of with particular pride to anyone who would listen. People loved him. That's genuinely not too strong a word, and not without reason. He was kind and generous, especially to children, and endearingly unpretentious. Introduced to President Coolidge on a sweltering day at Griffith Stadium in Washington, Ruth wiped his face with a handkerchief and said, "Hot as hell, ain't it, Prez?" At a party, he referred to the holders as the hostess and hoster. But at the same time, he commanded a certain wit. Once, when a traffic cop shouted at him, "Hey, this is a one-way street," Ruth yelled back, "I'm only driving one way." The sports writer Red Smith became convinced that Ruth possessed a first-rate brain, one that combined shrewdness with simplicity and innocence with penetrating perception. It was, in its special way, a great mind, he insisted. Those who knew him well weren't so sure, for Ruth's brain had wondrous gaps. He could never remember names, for instance. When Waite Hoyt, his closest friend, left the team for the Detroit Tigers after 11 years as Ruth's teammate, Ruth's parting words to him were, "Take care of yourself, Walter." He was equally hopeless at learning lines. Once, for a national radio broadcast, he was coached again and again to say, "As the Duke of Wellington once said, the Battle of Waterloo was won on the playing fields of Eton." When it came time to recite the line, Ruth proudly blurted, "As Duke Ellington once said, the Battle of Waterloo was won on the playing fields of Elkton." His extravagance was legendary. On one road trip, he wore 22 silk shirts in 3 days, then gave them all to the chambermaid upon departing. In Cuba, he lost $26,000 on a single horse race and $65,000 in a few days. It has been necessary for his employers to have him followed by detectives, to protect him from himself, as well as from confidence men, blackmailers, racetrack touts and bookmakers, gamblers and scheming young ladies, noted the New Yorker in 1926. Despite his wealth, often he didn't have the cash to pay his income tax bills, including in 1927, when Rupert made him the highest-paid baseball player in history. Over the course of his career, by his own estimation, he lost or wasted well over $250,000. His teammates did what they could to help him, taking it in turns to go through his mail to alert him to anything important. Ruth had 24 secretaries, Hoyt once observed. Doc Woods, the team trainer, once found $6,000 worth of checks in mail that Ruth had discarded. Wood also commonly faked Ruth's signature on baseballs and photographs, and reportedly faked some 10,000 signatures in 1 year. His appetites for sex and food, both seemingly boundless, were a source of perennial wonder. Marshall Hunt, sports editor of the New York Daily News, told how on road trips they would drive out into the country looking for restaurants that did chicken dinners. "What Babe really wanted," Hunt said, "was a good chicken dinner and daughter combination, and it worked out that way more often than you would think." His indiscretions often led to complications. Fred Lieb, the New York Evening Telegram sports writer who first called Yankee Stadium the house that Ruth built, once watched as Ruth was chased through a train in Shreveport, Louisiana, by a woman, reputedly the wife of a state legislator, armed with a knife. Ruth only escaped by jumping off the train and then back on again just as it was departing. On another occasion, he was chased near naked out of a hotel by an aggrieved husband with a gun. When someone asked his Yankee teammate, Ping Bodie, what it was like to room with Ruth, Bodie replied, "I don't know. I room with his suitcase." As the 1920s progressed, Ruth increasingly stayed at superior hotels to the rest of the team, at his own expense. There he would hold court to anyone who cared to drop by. Waite Hoyt once counted 250 visitors to his suite over the course of an evening. Ruth seldom knew who any of the visitors were. At a party in his rooms at the Book Cadillac Hotel in Detroit, Ruth famously stood on a chair and shouted, "Any woman who doesn't want to fuck can leave now." If sex was unavailable, he just ate. Marshall Hunt swore he once watched Ruth down 18 hot dogs at a sitting. Several witnesses reported seeing him order a dinner that consisted of double helpings of everything. 2 porterhouse steaks, 2 mountains of fried potatoes, 2 salads, 2 slabs of apple pie with ice cream, then come back 6 hours later and consume the same meal again. In between, he ate 8 hot dogs and drank 6 bottles of pop. "Lord, he ate too much," Harry Hooper, a teammate, told Lawrence Ritter in The Glory of Their Times. Over the course of his career, it was calculated that Ruth had gained and lost 2.5 tons. On the whole, he got away with his wayward lifestyle, but when he faltered spectacularly. In 1922, he had a dreadful year. He was suspended on 5 separate occasions for various behavioral breaches, and altogether missed about a third of the season. He squabbled endlessly with his manager, the long-suffering Miller Huggins. Once, when Huggins criticized Ruth and his teammate Bob Musil for their lack of discipline and output, Ruth carried the diminutive Huggins to the rear platform of the observation car and dangled him upside down over the rails until he withdrew his complaint. After Huggins's death, one of his sisters claimed that Ruth had taken 5 years off his life. In the winter of 1922, at what was supposed to be a testimonial dinner, Jimmy Walker, soon to be mayor of New York, and a man who knew a thing or two about high living, publicly castigated Ruth, calling him a great athlete, but also a great fool. Ruth, he said, had let everybody down by his loutish behavior during the season. Worst of all, Walker went on, you've let down the kids of America. Everywhere in America, on every vacant lot where kids play baseball, and in the hospitals too, where crippled children dream of movement forever denied their thin and warped little bodies, they think of you, their hero. They look up to you, worship you. And then what happens? You carouse and abuse your great body. The kids have seen their idol shattered and their dreams broken. Ruth, by this point, was sobbing piteously, but worse was still to come. As he left the dinner that evening, he was served a summons on behalf of one Dolores Dixon of Brooklyn, charging him with being the father of her unborn child. Ruth was in the embarrassing position of not being able to recall whether he had slept with the woman or not. In the end, it appeared that he had not. Dolores Dixon turned out to be a fictitious name, and the woman in question was unable to supply dates or places that tallied with Ruth's known movements. The suit was dropped, but not until Ruth had been made to look exceedingly foolish. In 1925, everything went wrong again. He arrived at spring training 40 pounds overweight and struggled to regain his form. In early April, as the Yankees were playing a series of exhibition games on the way home from spring training, Ruth began to feel unwell. By the time the team reached Asheville, he was feverish and barely coherent. Outside the train, he collapsed. As he was obviously in no state to play in an exhibition match, Miller Huggins, the manager, told him to continue on to New York. At Grand Central Station, he collapsed again and went into convulsions. He was rushed to St. Vincent's Hospital. Rumors circulated that Ruth had eaten too many hot dogs. The episode became known as the bellyache heard round the world. The hospital was curiously vague about Ruth's condition and treatment, which led others to suppose that he was being treated for syphilis or some other venereal embarrassment. It now seems evident that whatever ailed Ruth, it was seriously acute, and almost certainly gastric. Ruth was in bed for a month, and weak enough to need a wheelchair for several days beyond that. Altogether, he spent almost 7 weeks in the hospital. When he did return to the Yankees, he was sporting a fresh abdominal scar and was a ghost of his former self. He had lost 76 pounds during his illness and was now a trim but feeble 180 pounds, compared with the 256-pound tub of joviality he had been less than 2 months earlier. His legs were especially thin. He looked, said one observer, like a bag of oats on 2 toothpicks. But almost at once he returned to his former habits and within a month was becoming an overweight glutton again. On a road trip in August, the Yankees played appallingly, and Ruth contributed very little. More than once he fought with teammates. In St. Louis, after Ruth stayed out all night, Huggins fined him $5,000, a huge sum, double some players' annual salaries, and suspended him indefinitely. Ruth fumed and ranted, but eventually grew contrite and was reinstated to the lineup. He hit 10 home runs, batted a very respectable .345 in the last 29 games of the season, and didn't cause anyone any trouble at all. But by that time it was too late. The Yankees finished the season in next to last place, with a record of just 69 wins against 85 losses, and attendance was down by 700,000. In 1926, as so often with Ruth, he rebounded. He went through an intensive 6-week fitness regime, shed 40 pounds of doughy fat, and took almost 9 inches off his waistline. He had a good season, too. He hit 47 home runs, batted .372, and drove in 146 runs. Above all, he behaved himself, by and large. But in the World Series against the Cardinals, Ruth ended the year with an astoundingly ill-judged play. With 2 outs in the 9th inning and the Yankees trailing by 1 run, Ruth walked and then, to everyone's astonishment, tried to steal second base. He was thrown out by 10 feet, ending the game and giving the Cardinals the World Series. "I guess I did something rash," Ruth conceded. It was, by nearly everyone's estimation, one of the most foolish plays ever made in a World Series, and it undid nearly all the good that he had achieved during the season. So, at the start of 1927, Babe Ruth was in need of redemption again. That, however, wouldn't be easy now. He was 32 years old and suffered from low blood pressure, chronic indigestion, and occasional shortness of breath. This was not a man in his prime. It seemed highly unlikely that he would have a good year. In fact, and amazingly, he was about to have rather more than that. He was about to have a year that no one who knew baseball would ever forget. Chapter 10. In the summer of 1927, whenever Babe Ruth was missing from his usual haunts, he could often be found in a movie theater somewhere, sitting in a middle seat near the front, his broad face a picture of pride and delight, as he watched a 6-reel film called Babe Comes Home, starring himself and the Swedish actress Anna Q. Nilsson. Shot in 22 days the previous January at the First National Studios in Burbank, California, the film was by all accounts dreadful. No copy of it survives, so exactly what the plot consisted of is uncertain, but it was said to have been loosely modeled on Babe Ruth's own life, except, of course, that in the movie he didn't eat like a glutton, swear profanely, or have sex on the floor at frequent intervals. The movie was not, in any case, a success. The big hit of the season was a steamy offering called Don Juan, in which Hollywood heartthrob John Barrymore managed to plant no fewer than 143 kisses on compliant females, so many that hardly anyone later remembered that the movie was even more memorable for containing a soundtrack. Although Don Juan offered only recorded music and not speech, and hence was not a talkie, it still preceded the jazz singer as a sound picture by several months. In Manhattan, an even greater hit was not a feature film, but a Fox movie-tone newsreel showing exclusively at the new Roxy Theater of Charles Lindbergh's departure for Paris from Roosevelt Field. This, too, had a novel element of sound. Loudspeakers were set up in the theater wings, and a technician with good timing played a separate soundtrack so that the engine's initial sputters and final triumphant roar matched the images on the screen. It wasn't the most high-tech performance, even for the age, but it brought 6,000 patrons to their feet every time it was played. Against this, Babe Comes Home was pretty tame stuff. It was also notably unlucky in its timing, for it was released on May 22nd, the day after Lindbergh's arrival in Paris, when the world was fully caught up in the joyous mania of that achievement. But the movie was sufficiently bad that it probably wouldn't have found a following anyway. All this was a particular shame for Ms. Nilsson, who is forgotten now but was once so popular that she received 30,000 fan letters a week. In 1925, she was seriously injured in a fall off a horse and spent a year immobilized while convalescing. Babe Comes Home was intended to be her comeback movie, but it died quietly, unmourned by anyone but its male lead. Also easing his way into obscurity by this time was the increasingly hapless and marginalized Francesco de Pinedo. Pinedo and his two loyal crewmen had managed to get to Newfoundland ahead of Lindbergh, but then were pinned down by rough seas, one of the common and inescapable drawbacks of seaplanes. Lindbergh had actually flown straight over them on May 20th. Pinedo was able to get away 3 days later, but engine troubles brought him down in the sea 360 miles short of the Azores, and he had to be towed into the port of Faial by a passing Portuguese fishing boat. By the time his arrival was reported, Lindbergh was the world's hero, and nobody was interested in an Italian who reached his destination at the end of a tow rope. Still, Pinedo pressed on, but the final stages of his journey became small paragraphs tacked onto other aviation stories. On June 11th, he reached Lisbon. On June 15th, a small report in the New York Times noted that while flying to Barcelona, Pinedo had been forced down by bad weather near Madrid and had had to complete his journey by train. When at last he made it back to the Bay of Ostia, near Rome, the wider world hardly noticed. With Lindbergh at sea and out of touch, but for a daily ghost-written, or at least ghost-assisted, dispatch to the New York Times, which was nearly always agonizingly dull, the world craved some fresh excitement. Happily, things were beginning to stir again at Roosevelt Field. After Lindbergh's successful flight, no one was sure what would become of the two remaining teams, whether they would just pack up and go away, or try flights of their own. Charles Levine, the injunction against him lifted, now abruptly made clear that he still intended for his plane to fly. Early on the morning of June 4th, the Columbia was wheeled onto the grassy runway, and Clarence Chamberlain, dressed in a leather jacket, knickerbocker breeches, and patterned stockings that could be seen from half a mile away, emerged from the hangar, waved to the crowd, and climbed alone into the cockpit. Levine's belief seemed to be that if he couldn't get to Europe sooner than Lindbergh, he could at least get there more strangely. Nearly everything about the production was a little odd. For one thing, he and Chamberlain refused to say where the plane was headed. Nor would either say why Chamberlain was unaccompanied when the cockpit had a second seat for a navigator and co-pilot. Then something even more unexpected happened. As Chamberlain brought the plane around to its takeoff position, he slowed for a moment, and a bald, stocky man in a business suit bolted from the sidelines and climbed hurriedly on board. To everyone's astonishment, it was Charles Levine. Levine's wife, in evident confusion, cried out in dismay, "Oh, he's not going! He's not going!" When she saw that indeed he was going, she swooned and fell into the arms of the man standing behind her. Clarence Chamberlain later confided to a reporter, however, that Mrs. Levine had actually known all along that her husband was going, so the theatrics, it appears, were for the sake of the press. Minutes later, the Columbia was airborne, and the second flight of the summer to Europe was underway, though where exactly it was bound, not even the two men aboard knew. Their tentative plan was to try for Berlin, but in truth they would be happy to land almost anywhere. Levine quickly proved himself almost totally useless. He had no navigational skills at all, and in the one moment that Chamberlain let him try to fly, he almost immediately put the plane in a dangerous spin. His only real contribution was to reach for things behind the seat and help keep Chamberlain awake. Quickly, they realized that navigating a route to Europe was not as easy as Lindbergh had made it look. By the time they reached Newport, Rhode Island, barely an hour into the flight, they were 4 miles off course, and their earth inductor compass was not working. They were never quite sure where they were at any point after that. Luckily, Europe was a big target, and Chamberlain was the world's most laid-back pilot. It was just a question of going in the right direction, he insisted. Chamberlain was about to become, albeit briefly and somewhat tepidly, nearly as famous as Lindbergh. 33 years old in the summer of 1927, he came from Denison, Iowa, a town much like Lindbergh's Little Falls, one state to the north, though slightly more in the mainstream as it was on the Lincoln Highway. Chamberlain's father ran a jewelry store and repair shop, so the family was comfortable. Growing up in Denison at the same time was a girl named Donna Mullinger, who would later become famous as the actress Donna Reed. Today people in Denison remember her with great fondness. Hardly anyone remembers Clarence Chamberlain. Chamberlain's mother was English, and for reasons unknown, when Clarence was about 10, she moved back to England, taking Clarence with her. Chamberlain's autobiography is wondrously unrevealing on all aspects of his private life. He doesn't even disclose his wife's first name. She is simply Mrs. Chamberlain throughout. And he says nothing of his English interlude other than that he hated it. After about a year, they returned to Denison, and family life resumed as before. After high school, Clarence attended Iowa State College, as it then was, and acquired a degree in engineering. He learned to fly while serving with the Signal Corps during the First World War. He became a flight instructor and never saw battle, indeed never left America. Like most pilots, after the war, Chamberlain took whatever work he could find. For a time, he was an aerial photographer. Several well-known photographs of important events as seen from the air, including Yankee Stadium on its grand opening in 1923, were taken by Chamberlain. Like Lindbergh, he had also crashed a lot of planes, about 10 by his own estimation, and was involved in a fatal crash in an air race in 1925, when a passenger riding with him was killed. Chamberlain didn't actually know the passenger. It was just a young man who asked if he could go along for the ride. Oddly, Chamberlain seems never to have bothered to learn his identity. In his autobiography, Chamberlain merely records that he himself was knocked unconscious in the crash and learned afterwards that my companion had been killed. Chamberlain was seriously injured and was told by doctors that he probably wouldn't walk again, but clearly he proved them wrong. He was, if nothing else, fearless. Early on the morning of June 5th, passengers on the Cunard liner Mauritania, bound for New York from Cherbourg, were startled to see an airplane drop out of the sky and circle the ship just above deck level. The plane was recognized at once as the Columbia. Most of the passengers, who by chance included Raymond Ortieg, returning to America from his summer home in France to present Lindbergh with the Ortieg Prize the following week, assumed the visit of the Columbia was a kind of salute. The two men aboard waved in a friendly manner. In fact, Chamberlain was trying to find out where he was. He was looking for the ship's name to check against a list of sailing times in a copy of the New York Times he was carrying. Knowing how long the ship had been at sea would give him an idea of how much ocean he still had to cross. As it happened, he only just missed dropping down on the Memphis and being able to exchange waves with a presumably bemused Charles Lindbergh. Using the Mauritania's wake as a kind of pointer, Chamberlain adjusted his course, rose back into the clouds, and carried on towards Europe. That was the last anyone heard of him or Levine for many hours, but on the morning of June 6th, after nearly 2 days in the air, they came down in a field somewhere in northeastern Germany. Remarkably, neither Chamberlain nor Levine had thought to pack any maps of Europe, so they had no clear idea where they were. They had been in the air for nearly 43 hours and had flown 3,905 miles, breaking both Lindbergh's distance and duration records by considerable margins. The first person to greet them was a farmer's wife who was furious at the damage their plane had done to her cereal crop. Among others to turn up was, by rather extraordinary good luck, an airplane mechanic who was home visiting his mother. He spoke good English and informed them that they were at Mansfeld, near Eisleben, 110 miles from Berlin, and heading the wrong way. The mechanic knew how to order a delivery of aviation fuel, something that would have been entirely beyond them otherwise, but when the tanker arrived, its nozzle proved too big for the plane, so fuel had to be transferred laboriously via a long-spouted tea kettle borrowed from the farmer's wife, who had presumably calmed down a little. When at last the plane was refueled and the adventurers were pointed in the right direction, they took off again. Soon, however, they were lost once more. Chamberlain and Levine spent the morning flying around blindly and bickering over where they were before running out of fuel a second time and making another forced landing. This time they discovered that they had gone some distance past Berlin and were in a small town called Cottbus, almost at the Polish border. Footnote. Coincidentally, it was just down the road from Kamenz, hometown of Bruno Hauptmann, the kidnapper of Lindbergh's baby in 1932. Too tired to continue, they retired to Cottbus's best and only hotel and fell into bed. When they awoke, they found that they were national heroes in Germany and that a fleet of military planes had arrived to conduct them to the capital. The following morning, under a guiding escort, the two men flew the last leg to Tempelhof Airfield in Berlin. More than 150,000 people were waiting to greet them. An additional 20,000, misled by rumor, turned up at Warsaw Airport and were sent away disappointed. Germany gave the two flyers a reception as jubilant and welcoming as Lindbergh's had been in Paris. No humans would attract larger and more enthusiastic crowds in Germany until the rise of Adolf Hitler. America grew nearly as excited as when Lindbergh had landed. For 3 days, the Times in New York gave the two heroes its maximum headline, 3 decks across 8 columns, and covered their every thought and movement in exhaustive detail. The general public was excited, too. When Levine and Chamberlain's wives traveled to Hoboken Pier to catch a ship to Germany, 6,000 people turned up to see them off at 1 o'clock in the morning. Soon, however, the celebrations took on a slightly strained air. President Coolidge sent congratulations from America, but only to Chamberlain. His pointed snub was widely interpreted as anti-Semitic. The Jewish newspaper The Day observed from Manhattan, 2 men left New York, 2 men risked their lives, 2 men have shown heroism and created a record even greater than Lindbergh's. 2 men left, 2 men arrived, Americans both. But the President of the United States congratulates only one. And by strange coincidence, the one whom the President has not found worthy of being mentioned by name is named Levine. Lindbergh, in his daily dispatches to the New York Times from aboard the Memphis, also praised Chamberlain generously without once mentioning Levine, though this almost certainly was more out of bitterness at the way Levine had treated him over the Belanca deal than because of any active anti-Jewish sentiment. The Germans, too, seemed a little uncomfortable with Levine. A restaurant in Berlin started offering roast beef a la Chamberlain with cottbus potatoes, and a brewery sought permission to issue a Chamberlain beer, but again without mention of Levine. Levine, for his part, did almost nothing to ingratiate himself with the people of Germany. He visited no hospitals, called on no widows, offered no praise to German aviators. He didn't even have anything good to say about Lindbergh, attributing his success to favorable weather rather than skillful flying. "Lindbergh was lucky and we were not," Levine told reporters. "If we had 1/10 of Lindbergh's luck, we would have done much better." To the acute embarrassment of the German and American authorities alike, a German businessman, Dr. Julius Pupp, whom Levine had cheated out of $5,000 in a deal in America, now came forward with a writ and tried to have his plane seized. Chamberlain was amiable but had nothing to say and gave the impression of having not a thought in his head when not in the air, which was perhaps not far from the actuality. The world quickly realized that it didn't particularly like Charles Levine and was never going to get anything interesting out of Clarence Chamberlain, so its attention turned elsewhere. Lindbergh, though far away at sea and steaming home slowly, managed to raise a frisson of excitement with the news that he had come close to being swept overboard from the Memphis 3 days out from Cherbourg. The headline in the New York Times read, "Lindbergh in peril as wave traps him on cruiser's bow." The world's most beloved hero, it turned out, had gone for a stroll after dinner in rough seas, and was standing in the bow when a sudden succession of big waves crashed over the deck from the side, isolating him from the rest of the ship. Lindbergh had to hold tight to a lifeline to keep from being knocked off his feet and possibly swept overboard. B.F. Mahoney, the owner of Ryan Airlines, was also present, but safely on the other side of the crashing waves. Lindbergh waited 10 minutes or so for the waves to ease, then strode smartly back to safety. "It was an exciting experience," he related afterwards. It was not, however, a good omen for any nervous crew, of whom there were almost certainly many. This USS Memphis was a recent replacement for an earlier USS Memphis, which was sunk by a mysterious rogue wave in the Caribbean in 1916, with the loss of some 40 lives. It would not have escaped many of the sailors that Memphis was something of a cursed name. With Lindbergh temporarily unavailable, what America needed was some kind of sublimely pointless distraction, and a man named Alvin Shipwreck Kelly stood ready to provide it. At 11 a.m. on June 7th, Kelly clambered to the top of a 50-foot flagpole on the roof of the St. Francis Hotel in Newark, New Jersey, and sat there. That was all he did, for days on end, but people were enchanted and streamed to Newark to watch. Kelly had grown up in Hell's Kitchen, Manhattan's toughest district, in just about the grimmest circumstances possible. 7 months before he was born, his father, a rigger on construction sites, had plunged to his death when an assistant accidentally pulled the wrong lever on a derrick he was working on. Kelly's mother, heartbroken and bereft of a breadwinner, then died in childbirth. Kelly was adopted by the assistant and thus raised by the man who had accidentally but carelessly killed his own father. Kelly ran off to sea at 13 and spent most of the next 15 years as a sailor. He got his nickname, according to Time magazine, by surviving the sinking of the Titanic in 1912, but that seems to have been just a bit of inventive whimsy by a Time reporter. In fact, it came because he briefly tried to make a career as a boxer under the name Sailor Kelly, but he was beaten so often, he lost 11 bouts in a row, that he became known as the Shipwrecked Sailor. According to Kelly himself, he survived 5 other shipwrecks, 2 airplane crashes, 3 car crashes, and a train wreck, all without a scratch, during a busy career as a steeplejack, airplane stunt performer, and human fly, which is to say someone who climbs buildings for publicity purposes, before taking up flagpole sitting in 1924. By 1927, he had pretty much made the business his own. Kelly would reside for days or weeks on a tiny perch, a padded disc about the size of a barstool seat, attached to a flagpole on the top of a tall building. The most devoted admirers paid 25 cents to go onto the hotel rooftop, where they could see Kelly at comparatively close range and even engage him in conversation. The rest crowded the streets below, causing traffic jams and even trampling flower beds and breaking down fences through their force of numbers. Food, shaving implements, cigarettes, and other vital items were conveyed to Kelly by rope. To sleep without tumbling off, he would lock his ankles around the pole and jam his thumbs into 2 small holes drilled into the side of the seat. Normally, he dozed for no more than about 20 minutes, so that he didn't fall into a deep and forgetful slumber. Periodically, to please the crowds and relieve stiffening muscles, he would stand up on his precarious platform, an action that took considerable agility and not a little courage, especially if the wind was blowing. During the whole of his time aloft, he didn't leave the perch. No record appears to indicate how he dealt with bodily functions. For 2 days beforehand, and throughout the city, he took no solid food, just milk, broth, and coffee, which may partly answer the obvious question. He smoked 4 packs of cigarettes a day. Otherwise, he just sat. He billed himself as the luckiest fool alive. Newark proved to be more or less the summit of Shipwreck Kelly's brief career. He sat on many more flagpoles, once for up to 49 days, through blizzards, lightning storms, and other meteorological perils, but gradually the world lost interest in him, and flagpole work dried up. Kelly dropped from sight and didn't appear again until August 1941, when he was briefly jailed for drunken driving in Connecticut. He died of a heart attack on a New York street in 1952, by which time he was living in poverty. At his death, he was carrying a scrapbook of newspaper clippings of his old exploits. His age was given variously as 59 to 67 years old. Even now, in 1927 in Newark, newspaper interest in Kelly dwindled after the first few days, since there was never anything to report other than that he was still up there. By the time he came down and kissed his bride of 6 months, exactly 12 days and 12 hours after ascending, the public was little moved and the press barely noticed. Besides, a much, much bigger story had captured everyone's attention. Charles Lindbergh was home. Chapter 11. The more famous her son became, the more evident it grew that Evangeline Lodge Lindbergh was a little odd. Invited east for Charles's homecoming, she ignored an invitation to stay with President and Mrs. Coolidge and instead quietly checked into a Baltimore hotel. Since White House officials had no idea what had become of Mrs. Lindbergh, they were naturally alarmed. It would hardly do to lose the mother of the nation's greatest hero on the eve of his return. Luckily, a newspaper article disclosed her whereabouts, and officials were able to send a car to bring her, however reluctantly, back to Washington. The Coolidges were not living in the White House at this time. They had been moved out in March, the president, it was said, all but wriggling in indignation, so that urgent repairs could be made to the roof and third floor. They resided instead in what was being called the temporary White House, a mansion at 15 DuPont Circle lent to them by one Sissy Patterson, a member of the Chicago Tribune, New York Daily News, newspaper clan. One other house guest was present when Mrs. Lindbergh arrived, a gnome-like little man of 54, the increasingly ubiquitous Dwight Morrow. Mrs. Lindbergh seemed to enjoy and relax in Morrow's company. He was famously gracious, which was just as well, because in just under 2 years they would be bound by the marriage of her son to his daughter. Morrow had become almost absurdly rich as a banker with J.P. Morgan and Company. The Morrow family had a house with 32 servants in Englewood, New Jersey, and that was mostly just for weekends. During the week, they lived in a grand apartment in Manhattan. Stories of Morrow's absent-mindedness were legion and reported with relish in such places as the New Yorker's Talk of the Town section. The most oft-repeated Morrow story concerned the time he climbed into his bath while still dressed. On another occasion, he was reported to have used a visitor's bald head to knock the ashes from his pipe. Once a friend encountered Morrow at Grand Central Station, looking perplexed and feeling helplessly in his pockets. "Lost your ticket?" asked the friend. "No, worse than that," Morrow replied disconsolately. "I can't remember where I was going." His celebrated inability to keep himself satisfactorily dressed led Morgan Bank to post an attendant in the men's room, whose exclusive role was to make sure Morrow always returned to the world in a presentable state. In fact, in all these instances, Morrow was not so much absent-minded as incapacitated by drink. He was, it appears, a hopeless souse. Yet his mind was so sharp that even the most copious infusions of alcohol couldn't truly dull it. He was for years one of J.P. Morgan & Co.'s most trusted senior partners. Both Yale and the University of Chicago wanted him for their president. Morrow and Coolidge had been friends since they were college classmates at Amherst. Morrow seems to have been one of the few people of that era who thought that Calvin Coolidge had the makings of greatness. In 1920, he formed a committee to promote Coolidge, who was then governor of Massachusetts, for president. In the event, the Republican Party chose the more charismatic Warren G. Harding, but Coolidge's selection as vice president was in large part thanks to Morrow's efforts behind the scenes. Coolidge proved remarkably ungrateful. When Harding died and Coolidge succeeded him 3 years later, it was widely expected that Morrow would be appointed to the cabinet as Secretary of State or of the Treasury. But no call came. Not until 1925 did Coolidge give him any post at all, and that was a slightly demeaning one as head of the commission appointed to bring some order and discipline to America's chaotic aviation business. Now he was being invited to become ambassador to Mexico, another dubious proposition, since Mexico was in the throes of revolution and in a strongly anti-American frame of mind. Bandits roamed the country, often killing foreigners. Morrow accepted anyway. The morning of June 11th, Charles Lindbergh Day, dawned hot and clear. As the USS Memphis steamed towards its berth at the Washington Navy Yard, it was accompanied by 4 naval destroyers, 88 airplanes, 2 giant dirigibles, one of them the Los Angeles, whose last official duty had been to look for Nungesser and Coley on the lonely North Atlantic, and fleets of private boats whose sheer numbers and slapdash maneuverings added an element of mayhem and near misses to the proceedings. Onshore, a festive atmosphere reigned, with bands playing merry airs and a large crowd waiting in happy expectation. Mrs. Lindbergh was present too, but was unaccompanied by the president, to the surprise of many. In fact, Calvin Coolidge was not always terribly comfortable in a nautical setting. Recently he had been sent to review the American fleet from the bridge of the presidential yacht the Mayflower at nearby Hampton Roads, but got seasick, even though the ship wasn't moving, and refused to wear the naval uniform provided, a breach of protocol and an insult to the Navy. He went below after just 20 minutes and completed his review from a reclining position while looking bleakly out of a porthole. For Lindbergh's arrival, he decided to wait in the city. Mrs. Lindbergh was piped aboard and met Charles privately in the captain's quarters. Then the two of them stepped out onto the deck. Charles, dressed in a blue suit, looked rested and refreshed after a week at sea. The crowd issued an adoring roar at Lindbergh's appearance, and he was given a 21-gun salute of cannon fire, a tribute normally accorded to heads of state. Across the city, factory whistles sounded and church bells rang. Through the happy din, a radio broadcaster named Graham McNamee kept up a steady patter. McNamee was himself making history. His broadcast was being carried by 50 stations across the nation by the new National Broadcasting Company, America's, and indeed the world's, first radio network. 12,000 miles of AT&T telephone cables were pressed into service to give America its first coast-to-coast broadcast. It was believed that virtually every radio set in the nation was tuned in. No person in history had spoken to so many people at one time as Grand McNamee did now. McNamee's position as America's most trusted voice was entirely an accident. A Minnesotan, like Lindbergh, he had moved to New York as a young man to pursue a career as a singer in both light and serious opera. In 1923, while walking along Lower Broadway, he passed the offices of radio station WEAF. Knowing that radio stations sometimes aired recitals, he asked if there was any chance of an audition. The station manager, Samuel L. Ross, thought McNamee had the perfect voice for radio, warm and clear, so he hired him on the spot to introduce programs, read news bulletins, and occasionally sing. That autumn, WEAF had the rights to broadcast the World Series between the Yankees and Giants, the first time the series had been broadcast to a mass audience. W.O. McGeehan of the Tribune was employed to provide play-by-play, and McNamee was sent along to assist him. McGeehan had no talent for broadcasting. He spoke in a flat tone and made no effort to fill the dead space between plays. During the fourth inning of the third game, he told McNamee he didn't want to do it anymore and left. McNamee had no choice but to take over, which was something of a challenge since he knew very little about professional baseball. He was, however, a born broadcaster. McNamee described the crowds, the weather, the air of excitement that was rippling through the park. He picked out celebrities. He made the listeners feel present and welcome, like old friends. People loved his broadcasts, even if he didn't always entirely grasp what was happening on the field. Ring Lardner wrote on one occasion, "I don't know which game to write about, the one I saw today or the one I heard Graham McNamee announce as I sat next to him at the polo grounds." Soon McNamee's was the best-known voice in America, and not just for World Series games, but for every kind of important gathering. Championship prize fights, political conventions, Rose Bowls, and the arrival home of Charles Lindbergh. Lindbergh Day in Washington was in many ways the day that radio came of age. It takes some effort of imagination to appreciate how novel radio was in the 1920s. It was the wonder of the age. By the time of Lindbergh's flight, one-third of all the money America spent on furniture was spent on radios. Stations sprouted everywhere. In a single year, 1922, the number of American radio stations went from 28 to 570. Anyone could start one. Neushog Poultry Farm in New Lebanon, Ohio, had its own station. So did many department stores, banks, hardware stores, churches, newspapers, utilities, and schools. Productions at even the larger stations tended to be more than slightly amateurish. When Norman Brokenshire, a broadcaster for WHN in New York, found himself with a long lull to fill and nothing more to say, he announced, "Ladies and gentlemen, we bring you the sounds of New York City," and thrust the microphone out of the window. Not everyone was captivated by the new technology. Many believed that all the invisible energy flying through the air must be dangerous. One widespread belief was that birds found dead on the ground were there because they had been struck by radio waves. But on the whole, people were enchanted. The ability to sit in one's own living room and listen to a live event in some distant place was approximately as miraculous as teleportation. When an advertiser wrote, "Radio leaps the barriers of time and distance," it was as much an expression of wonder as of fact. For many, the broadcast of Lindbergh's arrival was nearly as notable and exciting as the arrival itself. "Here comes the boy," McNamee cried now as Lindbergh appeared on the deck of the Memphis. "He stands quiet, unassuming. He looks very serious and awfully nice. A darn nice boy." An estimated 30 million enraptured listeners hung on his every word that day. What none of them could see were the tears of joy running down McNamee's cheeks. Among the welcoming shore party were the secretaries of the Navy and of War, and a phalanx of naval officials, including Commander Richard E. Byrd, dressed in dazzling whites and still strangely and conspicuously earthbound. People were wondering if he was ever going to leave for Europe. It was not a matter he and Lindbergh could discuss now, for Lindbergh was hustled into an open-top Pierce Arrow with his mother to proceed under cavalry escort to the Washington Monument. No one knows how many people lined the streets of Washington that day, but it was universally agreed that it was the largest gathering the Capitol had ever seen. As his motorcade proceeded towards the mall, Lindbergh waved occasionally, but mostly stared opaquely at the crowds. Many of those lining the streets wept as he passed. They knew not just why, reported the writer and explorer Fitzhugh Green, who was also editor of Lindbergh's book We. At the Washington Monument, a sea of heads covered the entire visible landscape, and young boys filled the nearby trees like Christmas ornaments. At the foot of the monument stood a canopied platform on which President Coolidge and all the members of the cabinet but one were gathered. The lone missing figure was Herbert Hoover. He was stuck in Gulfport, Mississippi, still dealing with the Mississippi flood, which was as bad as ever, but almost completely forgotten now by those who weren't directly affected by it. Even Hoover's tireless PR operatives couldn't keep it on the front pages with Lindbergh in the country. When at last Lindbergh reached the speaking platform, he nodded to those present and accepted the cheers of the crowd. President Coolidge made a short speech of welcome, pinned a distinguished flying cross on his lapel, and with a gesture invited Lindbergh to speak. Lindbergh leaned into the microphone, for it was set a little low for him, expressed pleasure at being present, said a very few words of thanks, and stepped back. A moment of eerie stillness followed as it dawned on the watching throngs, most of whom had been standing in the hot sun for hours, that they were in the presence of two of the most taciturn men in America, and that this ceremony was over. But then, recovering their sense of occasion, the people burst into riotous applause and clapped until their hands were numb. Many wept here, too. And then began Charles Lindbergh's new life as a public figure. From now on, his every waking moment would be an endless round of banquets, speeches, and shaking hands. In just over 36 hours in Washington, Colonel Lindbergh, as he now was, would attend 3 banquets, make several short speeches, visit 6 soldiers at Walter Reed Hospital, lay a wreath at the tomb of the unknown soldier, and visit the Capitol. Everywhere he went, people lined the streets to cheer him as he passed. It was a touching display of adulation, but it was only the faintest prelude to what awaited him in New York. In the 1920s, America became a high-rise nation. By 1927, the country boasted some 5,000 tall buildings, most of the world's stock. Even Beaumont, Texas, had 6 buildings of 10 stories or higher, which was more than Paris, London, Berlin, or any other European city. J.L. Hudson of Detroit, in 1927, opened the world's tallest department store at more than 20 stories, and Cleveland saw the topping out of the 52-story Union Terminal building, the second tallest building in the world. Los Angeles instituted strict limits on building heights, which is partly why L.A. sprawls so today, but still allowed the City Hall to rise to 28 stories in violation of its own ordinances. It was as if the country couldn't stop itself from building ever upwards. As buildings grew taller, the number of workers pouring into city centers grew and grew. Boston, by 1927, had 825,000 people a day coming into its downtown, or more than the entire population of the city. Pittsburgh absorbed 355,000 workers every day. Los Angeles and San Francisco, 500,000 each. Chicago and Philadelphia, over 750,000 apiece. And New York, superlative in everything, took in a whopping daily load of 3 million. In 1927, New York had just overtaken London as the world's largest city, and it was easily the most cosmopolitan. A quarter of its 8 million residents had been born abroad. It had more foreign-born residents than Philadelphia had people. Native-born Americans were flocking to it, too. 200,000 Southern blacks had moved to New York since the end of the First World War, and now the Mississippi flood was sending tens of thousands more. As well as being the headquarters of many of America's principal service industries, banking, stockbroking, publishing, advertising, most of the arts, New York was still also the nation's largest industrial center. It was also home to 30,000 factories, One-tenth of all that America produced originated in the city. More than 40% of all America's overseas trade went through the port of New York, as did the overwhelming share of international passenger traffic. As many as 12,000 passengers sailed from piers on the west side of Manhattan every day, and something on the order of 25,000 would go to see them off. Such was the density of people around the docks that traffic was gridlocked daily for blocks around from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. Every 4 years, the city grew by the equivalent of a Boston or St. Louis. Developers couldn't keep up. At one point in 1926, more than 1,000 new office buildings were being constructed or rebuilt. To try to reduce the crowding, the city of New York enacted tough new ordinances, restricting tall buildings to big lots and forcing architects to design them with setbacks to allow more air to flow between them and more light to reach the ground. The unintended effect of this was actually to accelerate the pace of growth, since big lots required giant structures if they were to offer an economic return. It also encouraged skyscrapers to march northwards up Manhattan. By 1927, New York had half the nation's skyscrapers, and half of those were now in Midtown. The canyon-like streets and spiky skyline that we associate with New York is largely a 1920s phenomenon. Many of the new buildings added enormously to pressure on the city's stretched infrastructure. When the colossal Graybar Building, the world's largest office building, opened in early 1927 at 420 Lexington Avenue, it brought 12,000 office workers to one site. A single block in Manhattan now could easily contain 50,000 workers. All this high-rise density made New York the most breathtakingly packed and challenging city in the world in which to live and move about. But it also provided the most exhilarating and perfect backdrop for a ticker tape parade, and it was now about to have the biggest one the world had ever seen. On Monday, June 13th, Charles Lindbergh flew himself in a borrowed Navy airplane to Mitchell Field on Long Island, where he was immediately transferred to a waiting amphibious plane for the short trip onward to the city. He could not possibly be prepared, no human could, for what awaited him. What he saw now as he came into New York Harbor was perhaps the most extraordinary sight ever accorded an individual. An entire city, the greatest in the world, standing ready to receive him. The harbor was a mosaic of boats. Beyond, from the bottom of Manhattan to Central Park, people thronged every sidewalk and filled every rooftop and office window. No one can possibly say how many people witnessed the parade. Most estimates put the number at between 4 and 5 million. It may well have been the biggest crowd ever assembled anywhere to pay tribute to a single person. Lindbergh was met in the harbor by the mayoral yacht, a gift to the city from Rodman Wanamaker for the transfer to the Battery and the beginning of his parade. A buffet lunch had been laid on, but it turned out that the newspapermen and photographers who had gotten there first had eaten every bit of it, so Lindbergh had to face the festivities on an empty stomach. An estimated 300,000 people were waiting for him at Battery Park, where he climbed into an open-topped Packard and perched on the back seat beside Mayor Jimmy Walker, who was dressed, a little anachronistically, in a top hat. Lindbergh, as always, stayed bareheaded. They proceeded up Broadway through a blizzard of ticker tape and drifting confetti so dense that at times Lindbergh and Walker were all but invisible to those lining the route. The scale of the occasion was without precedent. After the Armistice Parade in 1918, street sweepers cleared 155 tons of debris. For the Lindbergh Parade, it was 1,800 tons. Some spectators, in their excitement, emptied whole wastebaskets out of their office windows, without always considering whether they might contain heavy objects. Among the items collected the next day were phone books and business directories and other bulky detritus that had been dropped or joyously flung from lofty windows and miraculously hurt no one. One person standing anonymously among the onlookers was a young woman named Gertrude Ederle, who may well have qualified as the most forgotten person in America. The daughter of German immigrants, her father owned a butcher's shop on Amsterdam Avenue, Ederle was the finest swimmer America had ever produced, of either sex. In a single day in 1922, she broke 6 national records. She was also as strong as an ox and capable of swimming vast distances. In August 1926, She not only became the first woman to swim the English Channel, but did it faster than any man ever had. This feat so impressed and excited her fellow Americans that she, too, was given a great ticker tape parade and was for a while so famous that crowds followed her everywhere. At the brief height of her celebrity, Edderly received commercial offers worth $900,000, but her manager believed she was worth more than that and wouldn't let her sign any of them. Unfortunately, the world simultaneously noticed that when out of the water, Trudy Edderly was not terribly interesting or attractive. She was a little stocky and not overblessed with charisma. She was also very hard of hearing, which made her seem irritable and impatient during press interviews. Just after her arrival home, another woman, a Danish-born American named Miel Gada, swam the channel too, which made Edderly's achievement suddenly seem slightly ordinary. The world speedily lost interest in Gertrude Edderly, and indeed in channel swimming generally. In the end, Edderly made just $19,793 in personal appearance fees. By the time of Lindbergh's parade, she was earning $50 a week as a swimming instructor and was able to walk through the city without attracting notice. When she was mentioned at all, it was as an example of the fate that no doubt awaited Charles Lindbergh. With stops at City Hall, St. Patrick's Cathedral, and Central Park, the parade took most of the afternoon. It was the start of 4 days of intense activity for Lindbergh, more speeches, receptions, honors, and parades, as well as a belated trip to see Rio Rita at the new Ziegfeld Theater. For the duration of their visit, Lindbergh and his mother had been lent the use of a large apartment at 270 Park Avenue, owned by none other than Harry Frazee, the man who sold Babe Ruth to the Yankees. By coincidence, Frazee's building had also been well known to Charles Neungesser. His beloved Consuelo hatmaker had resided there when Neungesser was courting her. It was at Frazee's apartment that Mrs. Lindbergh reluctantly agreed to meet the press in an informal press conference. Her performance was a masterclass in how not to answer questions. "What do you think your son will do next?" one of the reporters asked her. Mrs. Lindbergh said she had no idea. "Did he bring you any souvenirs from Paris?" asked another. "No," she replied. "Would you ever like to fly the Atlantic with your son?" "He hasn't asked me." "What are your plans for the next few days?" "They are in the hands of the organizing committee." And so it went for half an hour, until the reporters were out of questions and there were just long, awkward silences. When an assistant stepped in to end the conference, saying that Mrs. Lindbergh was expected elsewhere, the lady breathed an audible sigh of relief. "I've already said too much," she confided. There was no getting away from the fact that both the Lindberghs were a little odd, and that both together were more than a little odd. On the evening of his parade, Charles and his mother, accompanied by Mayor Walker, were driven to the Long Island estate of a multimillionaire named Clarence H. McKay, a banquet to be followed by dancing. Shortly after dinner, it was noticed that Lindbergh was no longer present. A panicky McKay instituted a search of the estate, unable to imagine what had become of his prized guest. It turned out that Lindbergh and his mother had departed from Manhattan without saying thank you or goodbye to their host, the governor, the mayor, or any of the other 500 guests. They evidently hadn't told the mayor that they were leaving him without a ride, either. For 3 days, Lindbergh's stories completely filled the front page of the New York Times and most of several pages beyond. On the day of his parade, Lindbergh's stories occupied the first 16 pages of the paper. Such was the intensity of interest in everything to do with Lindbergh that when Mrs. Lindbergh went to Pennsylvania Station on June 15th to catch a train back to the Midwest, 500 policemen had to link arms to hold back the crowds. Lindbergh was now the most valuable human commodity on the planet, and he was bombarded with lucrative proposals to make movies, write books and newspaper columns, advertise products of every description, appear in vaudeville productions, travel the world giving lectures. According to his own recollections, he was offered $500,000 and a percentage of the profits to star in a film based on his life story, and $50,000 to endorse a popular brand of cigarettes. Another company offered him $1 million if he would find and marry the girl of his dreams and allow the whole process to be immortalized on film. Senior figures in Washington urged him to enter politics. I was advised, Lindbergh wrote later, that if I would enter a political career, there was a good chance that I could eventually become president. So many parties tried to cash in on Lindbergh's name without his approval or knowledge that he had to hire a detective agency to track down the worst of them. The New York Times cited the example of an entrepreneur in Cleveland who found a man named Charles Lindbergh, a railway mechanic who knew nothing of aviation, and made him the nominal head of a company called the Lindbergh Aeronautics Corporation, with plans to sell $100 million in stock certificates to a gullible and admiring public. The biggest event of Lindbergh's week, of anyone's week, was a dinner given for him by the city of New York at the Hotel Commodore. The New York Times put the number of guests at 3,700, all male, since no women were invited. It was the biggest dinner ever given in the city. All the papers enjoyed listing the great quantities of food and crockery involved. 300 gallons of green turtle soup, 2,000 pounds of fish, 1,500 pounds of Virginia ham, 6,000 pounds of chicken, 125 gallons of peas, 15,000 bread rolls, 2,000 heads of lettuce, 100 gallons of coffee, 800 quarts of ice cream, 12,000 pieces of cake, 300 pounds of butter, 36,000 cups and plates, 50,000 pieces of silver. Though it may also be noted that only rarely did the numbers entirely agree from one publication to the next. Dinner was scheduled to start at 7, but because of the confusion of such a mass of people all searching for the right chairs, it was 9 o'clock before everyone was seated and serving could begin. The speeches didn't start until 11 o'clock, 3 hours late. The increasingly surreal and draining nature of Lindbergh's life was demonstrated on the evening of June 15th. After a full day of speeches and receptions, he finally got to a performance of Rio Rita, but the audience was so ecstatic to see him that police had to be called in to calm them, and the play started more than an hour late. It was nowhere near finished when Lindbergh had to leave to attend a benefit evening for Neungesser and Coley at the New Roxy Theatre. There he sat politely for an hour before slipping out of a side door and being driven to Mitchell Field, where he pulled on a flying suit over his tuxedo and took off for Washington. In Washington, he carefully went over the repairs done to the Spirit of St. Louis, climbed into the familiar cockpit, and returned with it to New York. At 7:30 in the morning, he landed at Mitchell Field in New York, content that he was at last reunited with his beloved ship. After a quick shower and a change of clothes back at the Frazee apartment, he resumed his public engagements on no sleep. As it turned out, the plans for Lindbergh on that day were wildly and unrealistically ambitious. He was sent on a long parade through Brooklyn, which included a speech to 200,000 people in Prospect Park, followed by a formal luncheon with a branch of the Knights of Columbus. Then he was to go to Yankee Stadium to meet the Yankees and watch them play the St. Louis Browns, before speeding back into Manhattan for the presentation of the Ortig Prize at the Hotel Brevoort, followed by yet another formal dinner. At Yankee Stadium, 3 sections of box seats had been freshly painted to receive Lindbergh and his party, and 20,000 fans turned out to cheer him. Babe Ruth had promised to hit a home run in his honor, but at game time, the great aviator was nowhere to be seen. The teams and spectators waited nearly half an hour for Lindbergh to get there, but when word arrived that he was still in Manhattan, the umpire started the game without him. Baseball seasons unwind slowly, and at this stage of proceedings, no one had any inkling that this season would prove unusually productive for Ruth or any other Yankees. Just before the season started, Ruth himself told a reporter that he didn't expect ever to break his 1921 home run record. "To do that, you've got to start early, and the pitchers have got to pitch to you," he said. "I don't start early, and the pitchers haven't really pitched to me in 4 seasons. As if to prove his point, he left the first game complaining of dizziness and failed to hit with vigor through the first month of the season. By May 21st, the day Lindbergh landed in Paris, Ruth had just 9 home runs in 32 games. Then 2 things happened. Babe Comes Home went on general release, and Ruth suddenly came to life. Goodness knows exactly how the movie galvanized him, but its release coincided exactly and peculiarly with his hitting a lot of home runs. 5 in 2 days. For one of which, in Philadelphia, the ball was hit so far that it left the park and cleared a 2-story house across the street. By June 7th, Ruth's total had jumped to 18, a much more respectable and promising number. 2 days later, against Chicago at Yankee Stadium, Ruth stole home plate, something that 32-year-old men with paunches didn't normally do. The season was suddenly getting interesting. True to his word, Ruth hit a home run for Lindbergh on Lindbergh Day. It came in the bottom of the first inning against Tom Zachary, who would yield a rather more momentous home run to Ruth at the end of the season. Lou Gehrig followed Ruth to the plate and hit a home run to almost exactly the same spot. Lindbergh, alas, never arrived to see either. "I'd been saving that homer for him, and then he doesn't show up," Ruth said afterwards. "I guess he thinks this is a twilight league." Lindbergh, through no fault of his own, simply couldn't get there. Delayed at every turn by people wanting to speak to him, shake his hand, have a moment of his time, he didn't reach Yankee Stadium until well after 5 p.m., when the game was nearly finished, at which point it was decided that he didn't have time to go in anyway. So his motorcade turned around and went back to town for him to collect the Ortig Prize from Raymond Ortig at the Hotel Brevoort in Greenwich Village. There, as everywhere, he was met by a mob and had to be bundled into the building through a sea of straining hands. Lindbergh was beginning to look distinctly shell-shocked. The historian Hendrik Willem van Loon met him in the midst of all this and reported with genuine concern, "Never have I seen anyone as hopelessly tired, as courageously tired, as that boy whose brain was still doing a duty which the rest of his body could no longer follow up. Another 3 days of this, and the reflected glory hounds will chase him to his death." In fact, Lindbergh had much more than 3 days of it to get through, and it would only get worse. He must at least have been glad to meet Raymond Ortig, for Ortig was a delightful and likable man, with a knack for putting people at their ease. He had started life humbly as a shepherd boy in the French Pyrenees, but in 1882, aged just 12, he had followed an uncle to America. There he taught himself English, got a job as a hotel waiter, and worked his way up the ladder of opportunity until he was first the maitre d', then the manager, and finally the owner of two of Manhattan's smartest hotels, the Lafayette and Brevoort, both in Greenwich Village. For Ortig, Lindbergh was a savior. The Ortig Prize, offered in a moment of impetuous magnanimity, had become something of a nightmare for the Frenchman. 6 men had lost their lives trying to win the prize, and until Lindbergh's triumph, it had seemed likely that the number would just keep rising. Critics had begun to observe that Ortig, however well-meaning, was a murderer, a thought that was understandably painful for him to bear. So it was with relief and pleasure that he handed Lindbergh his check, though he must also have felt a stab of unease at parting with such a hefty sum, for $25,000 was a great deal of money in 1927, and rather more than he could comfortably afford. The unfortunate fact of the matter was that Ortig was slowly going out of business, and he was being killed by the same thing that was killing lots of other people, sometimes all too literally, prohibition.